from WBUR Boston and NPR. I'm Tom Asbrook, and this is On Point. This week, a deadly train derailment, a presidential win on trade, Sunni leaders at Camp David, and Jeb Bush juggles the Iraq War. More questions over the Amtrak train crash in Philadelphia that left 8 people dead. NTSB lead investigator Robert Sumwalt said the train actually sped up going into that fatal turn.
16 seconds before the end of the recording, the train speed was going through 100 miles per hour.
Oh boy. Gulf leaders at Camp David nervous about a potential nuclear deal with Iran. President Obama looked to reassure.
I am reaffirming our ironclad commitment to the security of our Gulf partners.
And Jeb Bush all over the place this week on the Iraq War. Here's his Fox News interview with Megyn Kelly that started it all.
Knowing what we know now, would you have authorized the invasion?
I would have.
Well, maybe. This hour On Point, our weekly news roundtable with Susan Davis of USA Today, Michael Crowley of Politico, and On Point news analyst Jack Beatty. Joining me today from Washington, Susan Davis, chief congressional reporter for USA Today. Susan, welcome back to On Point. Great to have you here.
Hey, Tom.
Also with us from Washington, Michael Crowley, senior foreign affairs correspondent for Politico. We've got questions for you, Michael. Welcome back.
Thanks. Hi, Tom.
And from Hanover, New Hampshire, Jack Beatty joins us. Hello, Jack.
Hello, Tom, Susan, and Michael.
All right. Terrible, terrible train crash has snarled everything up in the Eastern Corridor and got a lot of people wondering about what's safe and what's properly funded. Philadelphia Mayor Michael Nutter out of the box on Tuesday saying that, he was ready to blame the engineer for what happened.
Clearly, he was reckless and irresponsible in his actions. I don't know what was going on with him. I don't know what was going on in the cab, but there's really no excuse.
And then it seemed to get weirder. The report yesterday that the train accelerated dramatically into that curve. Here's the National Transportation Safety Board's Robert Sumwalt again describing the train's dash cam showing the last few seconds before the train crashed.
Mere seconds into the turn, we could see the train tilting approximately 10 degrees to the right, and then the recording went blank.
8 dead, 200 injured in that. Just a terrible scene. Susan Davis, are we getting any greater clarity on what actually led to this terrible wreck?
Well, it seems clear as they discussed that the speed of the train was what led to it, to the derailment. What we don't know is sort of what's interesting is that the driver of the train says he doesn't remember what happened. He survived, but he has no memory of the crash. So it's going to take probably a more thorough investigation by the Transportation Safety Board. But as far as we know it right now, it is the speed at which they were taking the turn, which I believe is it's a route that I've actually traveled a lot over the years,
yeah.
Is that at the curve that they were hitting, they should have only have been going about 50 miles an hour max, and they were at double that, if not more.
But here's the news that it was actually accelerating into the curve, and it brings to mind, who knows what it brings to mind? I mean, is this like the old Toyota Camry stuck accelerator? Is this the airline pilot in Europe who drove his plane into the side of a mountain? Is this a suicide on rails? Is this something else? The train somehow accelerating outside the engineer's power? How are they going to figure this out?
Well, I do believe that trains do have, similar to airplanes, black boxes. And they said that they have retrieved that from the crash site. So I think that they're going to have more analytics on that. But with the train engineer saying he has no recollection of it and not admitting any kind of wrongdoing or purposeful action, we simply just don't know right now.
And then, of course, at the same time in Washington, you've got debate going on what to spend on Amtrak. You've got cuts to the Amtrak funding in the coming year. Here was Peter DeFazio, Oregon Democrat, ranking member on the House Transportation Committee, calling efforts to cut Amtrak's budget ironic given the timing.
Well, I would hope that our friends on the Appropriations Committee are cognizant of the real world out there, of what happened last night, of what the capital needs of Amtrak are, and will not engage in a short-sighted budget cutting.
But the budget was cut. Jack Beatty, we've got a terrible mess on the rails with a terrible death toll and lots of injury here. I mean, 200 injured, and these weren't minor injuries in many cases. What is the spectacle that we're gazing on here in horror, Jack?
Well, you know, there's a further irony here. According to the Times this morning, they were only months away from installing the safety devices high-tech safety devices at this on this stretch of track. And this had been following a congressional appropriation going back to 2008, and they were just getting around to that part of it. So it isn't as if Congress has done nothing on safety. They've appropriated it, and it's being spent. It just hadn't been completed at that particular place. You know, the Republicans have been opposed to Amtrak since it was started in the early 70s. They don't like the idea, just ideologically, of the government running a railroad. They keep saying it would all be done profitably without the, as they say, the $42 per ticket subsidy from the government. It would all be done without that tab to the taxpayer if a private company were to run it.
But Jack, well, wasn't Amtrak set up because the private carriers went bankrupt in the first place?
Yes, of course, of course. And experts say there isn't a railroad in the world, a passenger railroad, that doesn't need public safety subsidy. So the Republicans are not talking out of any kind of realism there, but their antipathy to funding it has just simply been, it's clear. It's very hard, though, to fault them on this particular safety equipment since they were in the process of putting it in.
Michael Crowley, give us a little global perspective here. You're a global guy. I mean, we see all these stories about record times coming out of very beautiful-looking trains in Japan, new systems in France. China has built so much new rail. They're going to build more in Latin America, not North America. Brand-new train east to west there. The spectacle of American infrastructure kind of falling apart while the rest of the world, the developed world, seems to go faster and faster and sleeker on the rails was very stark this week.
Absolutely. And if you want to zoom out a little bit, you know, this is a kind of core theme of President Obama, who is warning against the sort of austerity agenda of congressional Republicans. And, you know, I think he said it so many times in the past few years that we're sort of numb to it. But over and over and over again, President Obama says we need to invest. We need to build up our infrastructure. The rest of the world is soaring ahead of us. You know, some of America's major airports, New York City comes to mind, are actually an embarrassment when foreigners land. As opposed to if anyone has flown to China recently, you land in the airport there and, you know, you kind of – it's like being at Disneyland. You want to hang out
around
in the airport.
Right.
It's the coolest building you'll see. So there is – and, you know, and that itself is kind of a stand-in, a microcosm of this larger concern that that a lot of people in Washington have, that America is not keeping up, not investing, being outpaced by these nations that are growing faster than us, and we're going to wake up one day and say – hey, what happened? We got left behind.
Who's the third world here? Susan, I'm looking at numbers here that say it would take 21 plus billion just to repair and replace existing assets in the Northeast Corridor that have outlived their design, like this tracks and ties and electric wires and bridges and tunnels and all the rest around the trains. Is Congress prepared to do anything like that to keep the American train system in shape and safe?
No. Short answer, no. And I think what Michael touched on, which is exactly right, is it's not just our rail systems. If you talk to Congress, is also currently debating a highway bill. If you talk to the highway industry, they say we need almost the same amount of funds just to repair the nation's roads. Bridge repair in this country is also dramatically underfunded. Airports are another great example of infrastructure that has just fallen behind. So what Obama would like and what he has said he supports is sort of a Roosevelt-era infrastructure project that would take an incredible amount of government investment. And that is just not something that's going to happen in this current political climate. I think that Republicans do not see it the same way. I don't think that they want to invest that same level of public funding. I think they see more of a private free market and private industry solution to it, where they'd rather turn over some of these issues to have private companies and have them run more what they would say more effectively or for more cost savings. But yes, I mean, the transportation infrastructure in this country is underwhelming and underfunded, and it needs improvement. I do think it is worth noting, though, that in the Amtrak funding cut that they did in Congress this week, which was partly just bad timing, that the hearing was scheduled long before the crash, that they did not cut funding for safety and operations. It came out of a capital fund count. So it is important to say, to make that distinction, that they did not undercut funding for safety operations, although Amtrak supporters would say they still need more money than existing.
Jack, while this debate goes on, we look at our infrastructure just declining and declining. I mean, you can debate how to spend it, but we hear that the U.S. economy is one of the most effective at coming out of the recession at this point. And yet, among developed countries, our infrastructure looks the most tattered.
Yes, a $2 billion shortfall in investment, according to the American Society of Engineers, and no prospect that that's going to be filled. You know, I thought a couple of years ago the president's proposal for an infrastructure bank, a kind of public-private entity where there'd be private investment and public investment and so on, that would appeal to Republicans since it had the private element in it. But no way. The Republicans have a generic antipathy to public spending on public works. The economic argument for it is so persuasive, however, that you wonder, would a Republican president be willing to spend more? We don't know. I mean, because it's just so clear that whatever the president, President Obama, proposes, the Republicans are going to reject
but
that.
But, Susan, at a certain point, private markets don't work unless they have rails and roads over which commerce and life can take place.
Yeah, and I would also say that the side benefit of these transportation bills, which Democrats will also cite to, and many Republicans who support these transportation bills, they're jobs bills. If you pass an infrastructure bill, and they tend to be good-paying construction jobs, which is one of the reasons why they're also debating a highway bill right now, and there's a lot of bipartisan support to get that done, because a good long-term funded highway bill is an instant job creator in this country.
Meanwhile, the debate goes on and 8 people are dead. That really gives you pause. And 200 plus injured there in Philadelphia. Hugh in Jacksonville, Illinois. Hugh, thanks for calling. You're on the air.
Hi, Tom. I'm taking my call.
Yeah, what do you think?
You folks talked a little bit about what it's like when you go to another country and see the really advanced transit infrastructure. And I, the fall of 2010, I spent my first semester of my junior year abroad in France. And I had a family relative who was living in a city that was close to Paris. It's about the distance of Boston to New York. And I took a train from Paris to that city, and it was the TGV, the high-speed train. And anybody who lives in Boston or New York knows that an Amtrak train takes 4 hours to make that distance from Boston to New York.
Yep.
And the TGV made the trip in an hour and 20 minutes. So anybody who's been to Europe or really anywhere else where they have highly developed transit infrastructure knows when they come back to the United States what an embarrassment our investment in public infrastructure is.
Yeah, and it's France, it's China, it's Japan, it's a lot of places. It may be Latin America soon, China talking about building a big new rail line there. And then south of the border, going to be faster than north. Appreciate your call. I think that was Avery. Thank you, Avery. Hugh in Jacksonville, are you there, Hugh?
Yes.
Hi, what do you think about what we've seen here, Hugh?
Well, when I woke up, when I heard the train was sped up, it came to mind that possibility that the engineer might have nodded off or gone to sleep. There are federal regulations as to how long a time they get off before they're called back into service.
Do you have experience in this, Hugh, in this realm?
I worked on the track for 30 years on the railroad, but
that's experience.
But there were supervisors often would position themselves and watch train crews and see if they, you know, they're awake as they'd be going down the track.
But, Hugh, how would nodding off explain this rapid acceleration in the last 60 seconds before it went off the rails?
Well, I'm not an engineer. I don't know much about that, but there's a lever that you could bump up against there's positions as to increase the speed. I'm not sure if bumping up against it or pulling back or.
Well, you would hope and think in 2015 you wouldn't just nod off and lean against a lever and take everybody down. Hugh, I appreciate your calls. We've got to move forward. We've got so much to look at in this hour. We're going to leave that train wreckage there with our thoughts for the families of all those who injured and dead at the end of that terrible pileup. Another kind of pileup early in the week seemed to get maybe resolved later in the week. The big Pacific trade deal, the president wants fast-track authority to move it through quickly. He was stymied early in the week, and then maybe some Democrats came over to him. His own party was blocking the way. There were still some very unhappy with it. This was just yesterday, Senator Bernie Sanders, Vermont, saying that the TPP, the Trans-Pacific Partnership, would be a total bust. Here he was.
Are we dumb enough to continue down the road of failed trade policies? I would hope not.
But Democrat Senator Ron Wyden, Oregon, co-author of the Fast Track bill, said this is new. This is a new way to go. And finally, it looked like they were getting over the hump.
We are putting in place a modern trade policy, a trade policy that sets aside once and for all the NAFTA playbook of the 1990s.
Susan Davis, this is not NAFTA redux. This is something new. Is this back on the rails? Speaking of rails here, is the president going to have his fast track authority or not?
Probably. I think that, you know, it was sort of a false start earlier this week where Democrats voted together to block just to begin debating the bill. This was not a final passage of a fast track trade bill. This was just to get on the bill and start talking about it, start offering amendments on it. They relented. It was not a particularly there wasn't really a long game strategy that they had. And there's enough support for this bill that I am inclined to believe that not only does fast track get through, but if they can get fast track to the president, then it would seem very likely that he could get the Trans-Pacific Partnership through, which is, you know, probably the biggest legislative priority of his final 2 years of his presidency is to get this trade deal done. So there is a significant investment on the part of the White House in getting this through. What has been so fascinating politically watching it is how much his own party is against him. This is not a fight that we have seen in the Obama presidency. Democrats have largely marched with the president on the major issues of the day. And on this one issue, the vast majority of Democrats in both the House and the Senate are very much up against the White House. So we've created this new scenario where congressional Republicans are, you know, linking arms and talking about how right and smart Obama is on this and how we have to get this done. So it's a little bit of a surreal moment in Washington just listening to this debate and how it's broken down on the political lines. But yes, I think that, you know, they had 13 Democrats voted with all of the Republicans later this week to start debating the bill. They're going to move forward with it in the Senate next week, and I think that it has a very strong chance for passage. The House is going to be complicated, but it's on track.
Its own complications there. Jack, a kind of Democratic Party unraveling this week of what had been a consensus since what? Since NAFTA, at least in the Clinton years. President Obama and Senator Elizabeth Warren sparring back and forth. Obama asserting that, hey, look, these are my values, too. I wouldn't sign on to this unless I thought it had the right values about job creation at its heart. And yet you heard the depth of skepticism articulated this week, Jack.
Oh, yes. You know, the president says this is not personal between me and person he inadvisably refers to as Elizabeth. But the evidence suggests that it is personal. Consider this. For the last 2 years, Senator Warren has repeatedly said that the student loan program managed, run by the government, is run for and gains a profit. Experts at the Brookings Institute say no. The Washington Post ran a big piece about this over a year ago saying they didn't think that the evidence showed that. She continues to say it. It makes the education department, it makes the administration look like fools. We're you know, bilking those students. Two. Last fall, the president had to withdraw the nomination of Antonio Weiss, a longtime advisor on mergers for Lazard. He was going to be the Undersecretary of Treasury for Domestic Finance. He had to withdraw that nomination because of opposition from Senator Warren. What did she? What was she opposed to? Well, Mr. Weiss had, in his capacity as a banker, taken part in the merger of Burger King with Tim Horton. He had Tim Hortons, the Canadian fast food company. And she said that was, let's speak plainly, she says, this was a tax deal, plain and simple, an inversion. Well, the New York Times, Andrew Ross Sorkin writes, while it makes a nice soundbite, Ms. Warren, it is, to put it politely, mistaken. And he went on to show why that was not an inversion, and complicated reasons, and other things that she got wrong in this nomination. Finally, on fast track, she says this would, quote, easily allow a future trade deal to override domestic financial rules. Well, today, PolitiFact looks at that, and they say, well, at best, that's half true. There have been 17 of these cases over the years where the private companies have sued under various sued our system under various trade deals, and in all 17 of these cases, our courts have ruled against them. You know, the president said, Elizabeth, again, he probably shouldn't have put it that way, Elizabeth, Senator Warren is just another politician. And I think he was reflecting some resentment about the way she has, I won't say been coronated, but she certainly is treated with a deference, especially by the press, that most politicians they just assume they're demagoguing issues. People don't make that assumption.
Michael
her.
Crowley, do you assume at the end, when the smoke clears here and the Democrats are done duking it out with them among themselves, is there yet another trade deal, despite the sort of fundamental objections we have heard voiced in this outing?
I do. I default to the idea in these situations that when a president has a very high legislative priority that depends on his own party's cooperation, even if the relationship between the president and the Hill has been not great, to say the least, you know, bet on the president getting what he wants. That, you know, the power of a president appealing to members of his own party, I think, usually carries the day. I apply the same thinking to if there's a possible vote on whether or not to reject the Iran negotiations, which we can come to later. Mm-hmm. So I would bet on the president. And let me just add one more quick thought in the vein that I did before to kind of step out and look at this geopolitically.
Yes.
You know, an interesting thing about all this is, again, this idea of America's competition with China and trying to maintain its preeminent, you know, in this case, economic role, but overall geopolitical role in the world. And the president's argument in part is that, you know, if we don't keep up with advancing trade agreements, relationships, standards,
yep,
with all these countries, China is going to impose its own system, which is not a system that we want, that we endorse, that we want to see take hold. So we need to create a workable alternative to China rather than have China, create relationships with these countries which have much lower labor standards, environmental standards, you name it. So the president is arguing in large measure this is really about our competition with China, which applies in so many regards.
Weird that we're talking, though, about alternatives to China instead of in there with China. If, after all, talk about the Pacific, it's our major trade partner there. This week we saw the U.S. talking about getting its Navy more in the South China Sea, where China's been building out these little atolls and reefs and turning them into islands. Lots of concern this week about where that relationship is fundamentally headed. Meanwhile, back home, Democrats having their own debate. Sandy in Woodstock, Illinois. Sandy, you're on the air. Thanks for calling.
Oh, thank you, Tom. Thanks for taking my call.
Yeah.
I just wanted to make a comment about the trade agreements. Every one of them has chipped away at our tax base, our ability to be self-sustaining, which helped us, helped our side to win in World War II and World War I. The fact that we were able to produce all these goods in our own country, we no longer can do that. Because of these trade agreements, and our tax base has been eroded because people are out of work, and therefore they're not paying taxes. Instead, they're drawing money from our tax base.
Sandy, I appreciate your call. Jack, here's what I wanted to get to before. Is there a fundamental, Sandy's pointing at this kind of critique you hear a lot this week, is there a fundamental pulling away from what had been a consensus, though contested, but a consensus even so for years in this country, that in the end it's always free trade is the way to glory?
Well, you know, a poll earlier this month showed that 37% of Americans now say free trade with other countries helps the U.S. economy, compared with 31% who said that it hurts the economy. That doesn't look like a lot, but that's the first time in 15 years that a plurality has said it helps over the it hurts. So the public consensus seems to be, yes, it does help. But this isn't just the public at large. This is the Democratic Party and any Democratic senator or representative. One plant closing in their district or state, if any connection to foreign trade, they'll get blamed for it, for voting for a trade bill. So they avoid it. It's toxic to them. And they're responsive, to put it on the good side, they're responsive to the plaints of people who felt that their whole way of life has been undermined by these trade deals. On the other hand, the president has to stand for the whole American public and the whole American future. And is it, what would we think if a president simply automatically said, oh, I'm not going to have anything to do with a trade deal touching on 40% of the world economy? We would say that he was in retreat from our international role, and it certainly would be. And I think even if Elizabeth Warren were to be president tomorrow, she would see it in those terms, my guess is.
But plant after plant closing has got people's attention over decades now. Got to turn to Jeb Bush, and wow, what a week for him, squirming over the Iraq war. It began with this interview with Fox News' Megyn Kelly, unannounced GOP contender for 2016, though he sort of stumbled around on that, too, whether or not he was in the race this week. He was asked by Megyn whether or not, in hindsight, he would have invaded Iraq. His answer got a lot of attention.
On the subject of Iraq,
yep.
Obviously very controversial, knowing what we know now, would you have authorized the invasion?
I would have, and so would have Hillary Clinton, just to remind everybody, and so would have almost everybody that was confronted with the intelligence they got.
You don't think it was a mistake?
In retrospect, the intelligence that everybody saw, that the world saw, not just the United States, was faulty.
I would have. And everybody pounced on that. These people came out and said he misunderstood the question. Well, Chris Christie wasn't having much of that. Here he was talking with CNN's Jake Tapper on Tuesday.
Was that the right decision to go to war?
No, it wasn't. Now, I think President Bush made the best decision he could at the time, given that his intelligence community was telling him that there was WMD and there were other threats right there in Iraq. But I don't think you can honestly say that if we knew then that there was no WMD, that the country should have gone to war. So my answer would be no.
Republicans jumping all over Jeb Bush for I would have. He had a chance on Sean Hannity's show to clarify and, just said it's all hypothetical.
So in other words, if in 2020 hindsight, you would make a different decision.
Yeah, I don't know what that decision would have been. That's a hypothetical.
By the end of the week, he knew what the decision would be. Here he was at a town meeting in Tempe, Arizona.
If we're all supposed to answer hypothetical questions, knowing what we know now, what would you have done? I would have not engaged. I would not have gone into Iraq. That's not to say that the world is safer because Saddam Hussein is gone. It is significantly safer. That's not to say that there was a courageous effort to bring about a surge that created stability in Iraq. All of that is true.
Michael Crowley, interpret, why did it take a whole week for Jeb Bush to come around to that? Because it was his brother who took us there? Because he's got the same foreign policy advising team that his brother had, Paul Wolfowitz plus?
Well, it's a bit of a mystery. I gravitate to the theory that it's the family, and the family, you know, your family makes you do strange things sometimes. It sometimes forces you to defy reason and logic. We didn't actually learn. He didn't say anything substantively surprising. I mean, through this long process, he came down where I think anyone would have predicted. It's in sync with comments that he said in past years, and I really do feel that you know, that first answer he gave was an answer to a different question, and so he either really did mishear the question, or to go back to the point about family. Just ran from a trap that was going to inevitably pit him against his brother. So I think what we really learned here was not so much about how he thinks about foreign policy and what kinds of decisions he would make as a president. I think it was a couple things. One, that he is a little rusty and needs to be better prepared as a candidate. And two, that he is going to have a hard time escaping the shadow of his brother. This is going to be a bigger problem for him in the campaign than I think he may have anticipated.
We've got more to look at on the Jeb Bush front and well beyond. Michael Crowley, please stand by in Washington with Politico. Susan Davis, Chief Congressional Reporter at USA Today. Jack Beatty, we're looking at a week in the news. You can join us. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We'll be right back. Hi, everybody. Tom here. I'm glad you're joining us for this On Point podcast. Before we get back to the show, I'd like to tell you about another podcast you might enjoy, too, Dear Sugar Radio. Join hosts Cheryl Strayed and Steve Almond as they field questions about love, sex, work, guilt, money, you name it. That's Dear Sugar Radio. You can find it at wbur.org/Dear Sugar or subscribe on iTunes. In other news this week, a Picasso painting breaks the record for the highest price paid at auction, $179 million for Picasso's La Femme d'Alger. Here's Christie's auctioneer, Jussi Pelkanen, on Monday.
It's yours, so The 1955 Picasso was the best of its type and arguably one of the greatest Picassos still in private hands.
I hope so. $179 million. Deflategate penalties for Patriots QB Tom Brady, a four-game suspension. John Stewart says there's a good chance that punishing Brady will only make him stronger.
Four games without pay. Obviously, he doesn't need the money. And at his age, you know, maybe the break might even help preserve his career and probably spend that time on the beach with the family he loves. It's not even a punishment. He wins again. He always wins.
It's not even a punishment. And blues legend B.B. King has died at 89. Here's one of his signature songs, the biggest hit of his career after a tough breakup in his own life. From 1970, The Thrill Is Gone.
Thrill is gone. The thrill is gone away.
Join us. We're looking at a week in the news. What do you make of Jeb Bush on the Iraq war? Is the Vatican right to recognize statehood for the Palestinians? Are you doubting the Obama telling about how Osama bin Laden died? And what are you thinking on the Hattiesburg police killings, Deflategate? Brendan is calling from Belchertown, Massachusetts. Brendan, you're on the air.
Thank you for taking my call, Tom. I'm concerned about Jeb Bush saying mistakes were made. But Jeb is taking advice from the people that made the mistakes, such as Paul Wolfowitz. And to me, the biggest mistake was declaring war and a tax cut for the wealthy at the same time, kind of followed by an attack on Social Security. That was a big mistake.
Brendan, let us pick it up right there. Michael Crowley, what about Jeb Bush's advisory team? You do have Paul Wolfowitz on it, neocon. He was, what, Deputy Defense Secretary, chief architect of the Iraq War, still a staunch defender. He's right there in the middle of Jeb's advisory crew.
Yeah. Condoleezza Rice is another, although she was a little less hawkish, certainly in the latter years of W's presidency, but certainly a lot of staunch conservatives. And I believe that Jeb told an audience of donors recently that his brother remains one of his top advisors, or his top advisor when it comes to the Middle East. So that will give people who were not big fans quite a lot of pause. But I think it's still just not clear how he thinks and how he would act on these things. He's got a pretty thin track record when it comes to foreign policy. You know, I looked at what evidence there is of his views going back, you know, 15, 20 years, and there's some conflicting evidence. I think that, you know, given the doubt, I suspect he will sort of gravitate toward the center of his party, which is in a pretty hawkish place. So, you know, I would focus a little less on the advisors than on where is the Republican Party generally. And it is, you know, in an interventionist, kill the bad guys mood right now. And I think that's probably where he'll go. I would just add, by the way, that, you know, mistakes were made is such a cop-out. And, you know, when you're talking about something, the magnitude of the Iraq war, and people are asking you nuanced questions about what we should have done, I just think it's a really pathetic thing to say. And I would love to hear him expand on that a little bit.
Mistakes were made. Susan Davis, I mean, whether it's Jeb Bush or, for that matter, Hillary Clinton, this week reminds us that when you look at brothers or wives, family of those who have been president, there's always a shadow from that. I mean, Bill was her husband. George was his brother. In their own policies and statements, they may feel limited to how far they can go without impugning their near and dear.
Yeah, it's true. And there's an obvious parallel there. I think you also get a sense when Jeb Bush and Hillary Clinton are asked questions about their brother and father and husband, respectively, that they almost seem irked by it. Like they're tired of responding for what their family members did. But it's a fair question. And the challenge that both Bush and Clinton have, if you believe that they are the presumptive favorites for their nominations, which they seem to be at this point in time, is that their challenge is that they have to convince voters that they are a uniquely different candidate than their family members. And I think that is particularly hard to do when your inner circles are filled with the people that also advise the other administrations, and their fundraising networks are essentially the exact same people. And I think that is where some of the other candidates in the race see the strongest opening. If you listen to candidates like Marco Rubio, when he repeatedly says things like, We need a 21st century candidate for the 21st century, or elections are about the future, not the past. I mean, those are ways that he's trying to speak to the voter without particularly going directly against Jeb Bush, who is, you know, an ally and a friend of his. So he can't go hard against him. But that is the message, that we need new, different candidates for the future. And there's something to be said there. I think that when we have to keep relitigating the Iraq War, which is a question that Hillary Clinton, which you could argue sort of downed her candidacy against Barack Obama in 2008, because that was the signature difference between them, was that he opposed the war and she voted for it. Mm-hmm. So to the extent that American voters want to keep relitigating the past and past votes, it'll be interesting to see. I think there's sort of the public's kind of tired about having these debates, too, and they want new ideas and new debates. And whether Jeb Bush and Hillary Clinton can change that conversation remains to be seen. Currently, right now, they can't.
Marco Rubio. Yes, Jack.
Well, I was just going to say, it looks irrational and foolish this week, but there's a political calculation here. George W. Bush's popularity is over 80% among Republicans in Iowa and South Carolina. And in the last poll I saw out of Iowa, Jeb Bush was seventh. So what looks to be some sort of scramble had a political calculation, too, to sort of pay his homage, and more than his homage, to a brother who's very popular among Republican primary voters.
Marco Rubio planting his flag this week on foreign policy as a tough guy along the lines you're describing, Michael Crowley. Here he was at the Council on Foreign Relations laying out his foreign policy, sort of the Rubio doctrine.
These are the three pillars of my doctrine: American strength, the protection of our global economy, and a proud advocacy for America's core values. This approach will restore American leadership to a world badly in need of it. It will reestablish a foreign policy based on strategy and principle, rather than one based on politics and polls. One that is overseen by the White House, but not micromanaged by it, and that will restore America's status as a nation that shapes global events, not one that is shaped by them.
Michael Crowley, is that George W. Bush too?
Well, yeah, there's a lot of resonance there. And, you know, particularly it was interesting to hear him talk about morality, democracy and freedom. There's not been a lot of talk of that. It's not something that President Obama is very interested in. It does lead him into contradictions, which he didn't address in the speech. For instance, he talked about affirming our alliances. I think he may have referred specifically to the Gulf monarchs who were at Camp David. You can either have a, you know, rock solid alliance with those monarchs, or pursue democracy, freedom, and human rights around the world, but those two run into tension. In other words, a lot of our allies in the war on terror, who he says we're not treating well enough, run authoritarian, repressive regimes, and we have to make a choice between our interests and our values in those cases. But overall, I think Rubio acquitted himself quite well. The reviews of his speech were very good. He gave a decisive, quick answer to that question about, knowing what you know now, what would you have done in Iraq? He said, I would not have gone in. And I think he looked, solid on his feet versus Jeb Bush. And finally, I would say, you know, he has that vision, the three pillars, thoughtful take on all this. But the thing that really struck me was the other day, I think this was this past Sunday, he was talking about his vision of the war on terror and quoted a line from the movie Taken, in which Liam Neeson says, we will look for you, we will find you, and we will kill you. So to the mood of the party right now, I actually think that is the core of it. And I think that's the direction that all these candidates are headed.
Sounds a little bloodthirsty. He was very happy to kick Hillary Clinton as he laid out his Rubio doctrine.
We simply cannot afford to elect as our next president one of the leading agents of this administration's foreign policy, a leader from yesterday whose tenure as Secretary of State was ineffective at best and dangerously negligent at worst. The stakes of tomorrow are too high to look to the failed leadership of yesterday.
Be ready to hear more on that front. Michael Crowley, you mentioned the Gulf leaders meeting at Camp David this week with President Obama, not the Saudi king who was expected, who was promised, but in the end made a late cancellation. But give us a sense of what made this meeting necessary and how those Gulf leaders went away from a half dozen countries after sitting down at Camp David. What do they think?
Well, what made this meeting necessary was the Iran nuclear negotiations. And a problem that has plagued the nuclear talks for President Obama made it difficult for him to sell the talks at home and abroad is the sense among the Sunni Arab countries who see Iran as a Shiite Iran, as a mortal enemy, that Obama wants that a nuclear deal with Iran would be the first step towards a larger and deeper alliance between Washington and Tehran that would kind of throw our old allies in places like Saudi Arabia under the bus. Their vision of what Obama is up to, which I think is exaggerated, but their vision is that Obama will, you know, strike this friendship with Iran, that they will be our strategic partner, and we will use that new relationship to begin disengaging from the Middle East and pivoting to Asia. In addition, I think the Gulf Arabs have legitimate concerns about a nuclear armed Iran. They think that at the end of when this deal sunsets, Iran will be capable of quickly getting a nuclear bomb, and that is understandably quite alarming for them, given the friction and hostility between their countries and Iran. So, President Obama, when he struck this framework sort of deal to make a deal last month, right away said he was going to invite these Gulf Arab leaders to Camp David to sit them down, reassure them that he is not about to change America's strategic relationship with Iran after 30 years of hostility, to explain to them why the deal is not something they should be afraid of in technical or strategic terms. And it seemed like a good idea. I think from the White House's perspective, this ended up being a very mixed bag. You know, White House officials will tell you the coverage of this so-called Saudi snub, which was the Saudi king's commitment to come to the summit and then last-minute decision not to come, and also some other leaders didn't come, got a lot of coverage. They would say that's unfair, but I think it really cast a cloud over the whole thing. And at the end of the day, not that much came out of this meeting. There was a lot of coverage about the differences between Obama and these leaders, not a lot new. So I think it was kind of a mixed bag.
It's not unfair. On Friday, they say he's coming. On Sunday, it turns out he's not. That's news.
Yes.
And can you really have it both ways? If Obama says we're not about to change our strategy relative to Iran after 30 years, and yet isn't the deal itself, isn't at the heart of it, an assumption that better relations with Iran will lead them themselves to walk away from pursuing nuclear weaponry, Michael? Isn't that implicit in this deal?
Yes. That is. Very quickly on the question of the king, you know, was it a snub? Was it meant to send a signal of unhappiness to Obama? Was it meant to sort of point out, you know, we're angry at you? I'm not sure that's the case. I think that it was not the most agile diplomacy on the part of the Saudis. I think there may have been other reasons the king didn't come that were not necessarily kind of a poke in the eye, which is how the press covered it. But, you know, it is what it is. And I think it really kind of threw a wet blanket over things. On your second point, yes, you know, and that is a theory in the administration. I think there are competing views of what this deal is going to do. Publicly, what the president says is the nuclear deal is only about blocking Iran's path to a nuclear weapon. That's all there is to it. That's why we're doing this. But there is a school of thought that says if we can kind of break the ice, you know, the Iranians for decades, the regime has said you can't trust America. You know, it's the great Satan. They're only out to manipulate and deceive and do bad things to Iran. Well, if you can cut a deal with America, if you can show that we can be trusted, maybe that opens the door to cooperation on other issues of mutual interest. For instance, the war against ISIS. Iran sees ISIS as a threat also. And then you can start to see one step after another, the building blocks to a more normalized relationship. But I just say that, you know, the anti-Americanism in this regime runs so deep that you would really have to have a pretty fundamental change at the top of the ladder in that country. The population as a whole is pretty pro-American, but this regime is so hostile to America, so premised on this rhetoric, that I think that there would have to be dramatic change, and I don't think it's going to happen anytime soon.
Susan Davis, the House passing yesterday a bill that would allow Congress to review, potentially reject a nuclear deal with Iran. What about the Iran deal? Once it hits Congress, what are its prospects looking like?
Well, assuming they get a deal and they're aiming again towards later this summer to finalize a deal with Iran, that what Congress essentially has both chambers have passed and President Obama has said will sign is legislation that would give Congress a 60-day review period to review the deal that they reach and give them an opportunity, if they were to choose to do so, to reject the deal or vote for a resolution of disapproval, which – you know, in some ways is really more about Congress just trying to exert their authority over this kind of deal, because it, practically speaking, even if they were to vote against it, they would need veto-proof majorities in both chambers in order to really sort of derail it. And it's unlikely that they would have that level of support, because even Democrats, I think, who voted for this legislation and would like to have some review period would ultimately back the president at the end in reaching a deal, because I think that they see the long-term importance of it. But it was something that the White House originally came out and threatened to veto and said they wouldn't support. And I think when they saw the overwhelming bipartisan support for it in both chambers, they sort of relented and backtracked and said, well, okay, we'll sign it. I think in part because they know that they have this veto-proof majority and sort of the card in their back pocket. So it's also been a way, because I think so many members of Congress, when you talk to them, say this isn't just an ordinary sort of diplomatic negotiations. It's Israel, it's Iran, it's things that their voters care deeply about. It's something that members of Congress would like to have a voice in. Although this Congress in recent years has not had a particularly unified or clear voice when it comes to when they've been asked to weigh in on foreign policy. They were, you know, they were, it was hard for them to get near a Syria resolution, which was resolved in other measures. The president has asked for an authorization of use of military force to be renewed, and they haven't been able to get around to that. So they've had sort of a murky record on weighing in on international relations.
We're thinking about Hattiesburg and the police there this week, about Madison, Wisconsin, and Tony Robinson there. No indictment of the officer who shot that unarmed teenager. And of course, the reporting on Osama bin Laden, whether we got the full story on that or not, ends this week, just right up in the air and disputed after Seymour Hersh's piece. I want to thank all three of you for being with us this hour. Michael Crowley at Politico, thanks so much for joining us today.
Thank you, Tom.
Susan Davis at USA Today, thanks for joining us, Susan.
Thanks, Tom.
And Jack Beattie, great to have you. Thanks for being here.
Thank you.
Listeners, same to you. Thanks for joining us. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point.
On Point is a production of WBUR Boston and NPR.